We're talking about the future of biodigesters in Wisconsin. Turning manure into money. That's a phrase plucked from headlines. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. Microsoft claimed recently it had partnered on the first solar-powered biodigester in the world, located in Dubai. Closer to home, though, there's a bill in the legislature to give grants for establishing regional biodigesters. Also, federal legislation in the Agriculture Environmental Stewardship Act, reintroduced last summer, would provide tax incentives to farmers to invest in biogas technology. So what questions do you have about how animal and food waste can be converted into energy? Should there be more incentives to incorporate biodigesters into our renewable energy mix? 800-642-1234. Jessica Niekratz is board chair of the Wisconsin Biomass Energy Coalition. That's a trade group promoting renewable natural gas digester facilities. Jessica, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, school us first, please, if you will. Explain how biodigestion works to eventually create biogas as an energy source.
Sure. You can think about digesters really like a giant stomach. We are essentially replicating what happens inside of the cow. The manure is brought into a facility, either underground or by truck. It's then processed for an average of about 25 days, during which the same kind of bacteria and bugs that live in our stomachs are inside those tanks. And as they process and break down the manure, methane is created. The methane floats up to the top of the tank, is siphoned off, and then can be used for multiple outsources. Electricity has been the historical use, and renewable natural gas is really the way that these projects are penciling out these days.
So methane, the main component of natural gas, can be, you say, produced by this bioreaction that comes from cow dung or food scraps or other organic matter. Is that right?
That is true. Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, I vividly recall seeing one of the early biodigesters installed in, you know, as part of a community college project in Iowa, and that was over 20 years ago. And it was touch and go on the technology, not efficient for the farmer, very, very expensive, involved a huge kick of a government grant to make the thing. Has the technology come along and improved the process of this? You know, how efficient is the system today?
These are delicate systems. We're dealing with waste, with, you know, animal waste, and it has a corrosive element to it. Hydrogen sulfide is one of the byproducts of manure, and it likes to eat stainless steel for breakfast. So every facility needs a very rigorous maintenance plan, people who understand how these systems operate, and you know, still also know how to pivot and respond when things don't go according to plan. We have learned a lot in those years, however, and, you know, systems have been redesigned to be more efficient. And, you know, just the use of the methane coming off, at this point now has completely different technology that's being used. No longer the electric generators have sort of been of years past, and now these renewable natural gas skids are the option where we filter out all those contaminants.
Talking with Jessica Niekratz, who's board chair for the Wisconsin Biomass Energy Coalition. She's president of Clean Fuel Partners as we talk about the future of biodigesters. You can join in. Are you a farmer operating one? What made you explore that as an option? How does it work on your farm operation? 800-642-1234. Jessica, you need a large cattle operation to make the system work. You need land. Will biodigesters only work for CAFOs, for large feeding lots where you have a lot of cow input? Or can small and mid-sized farmers still see these as viable on their farms?
Yeah, pardon me. And to this point, the industry has looked at farming operations of 3,000 animal units or more. That has been the easiest approach to setting up these facilities. What we're doing with a legislative effort that has not yet been introduced is to increase access to pipeline, to the natural gas pipeline, so that we are able to site multiple farms to one processing facility and then use, collect that gas as a whole, sort of as the community digesters have been, and then create those projects accordingly.
Oh, so you've got the manure digester and you're producing biogas, but how do you get it off the farm? What about that pipeline infrastructure to move the energy?
Yeah, the way that these projects pencil out is by working with the state of California and their low carbon fuel standard. And what California has said is any organization, company that is using gas or diesel needs to offset their use of that by purchasing credits. Turns out that CalMNR has a very, very low carbon intensity score. And let's say a gallon of diesel has a carbon intensity score of plus 90 to 100. CalMNR has a negative carbon intensity score ranging anywhere from 200 to 400. Mm-hmm. So these credits are fueling our use. And this is an introduction to your question in that a lot of how far we need to transport this gas influences that carbon intensity score. So greater access to the pipeline will allow more projects to pencil out in a beneficial financial way.
Okay, so Renew Wisconsin says 34 biodigester farm operations exist in Wisconsin. Where do you see this headed? I mean, is that number correct?
That sounds about right. That sounds about right. A lot of these projects have switched from electricity because of the power purchase agreements expiring to the renewable natural gas. And in all honesty, it's a really good opportunity for investors at this point because these projects are making a lot more than they did with electricity due to both the federal RINs available and the low carbon fuel standard out in California.
Well, looking at the economics, can you really make enough money off the energy they produce to run a system so it pays for itself? Can you explain the economics here?
I can do that on sort of a high level loose basis, but essentially farms, we're having outside money from outside the state coming in to fund these projects. I would bet my bottom dollar that any farm with 3,000 animal units or more has been contacted by a developer regarding these projects. They pencil out very well where the payback is within 2 to 4 years.
Talking with Jessica Niekras, chair of the Independent Trade Association, the Wisconsin Biomass Energy Coalition. Are you a dairy farmer using a methane digester? What can you share about your system, the resulting biogas, if that is what is being produced? Do you think biodigesters are a step in the right direction, or is the technology coming up short to address the climate crisis, missing the mark? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're at the intersection of biogas, dairy producers, and what the future holds for biodigesters and the transition away from fossil fuels. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As dairy farmers have an eye on sustainability, incorporating biodigesters onto the farm may help in the transition to renewables and provide an additional revenue stream. But there are barriers like the high upstart costs, only economically feasible for larger farms. With lots of cows and large manure tanks. Are you a farmer who operates a biodigester? What have you learned through your system? Should the state and federal incentives build up more for biodigesters in our state? Join in 800-642-1234. Jessica Niekras chairs the Wisconsin Biomass Energy Coalition and is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's take a call now. George in Monroe. Hi, George.
Hi. I have two quick questions. Once this gas is created, how does it get transported into where, you know, off the farm and into where it's usable for the public? And the second question is, would this, if these are built in bulk, is that going to help the reduce the amount of nitrates that get spread on the soil from just the manure being spread over and over again from these factory farms?
Having a little technical difficulty. I can't seem to hear Jessica.
Oh, dear.
Okay, are you there, Jessica?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, if you could start again. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing.
Okay. George, the gas is purified on this at the processing site and then goes into some a truck, at which point it is then taken to a facility that will measure the purification of the gas. And if it meets the pipeline quality, it is then injected. And then with your other question about nutrients, the one thing that digesters can do is they can create the option for separating nutrients. So we can take the contents of those tanks and separate them into a liquid and a solid portion. The liquid portion is greatly reduced in nutrients. And for whatever reason that Mother Nature's created, the larger portion binds to those solids. So what it allows us to do is take those solids from areas where they are not really welcomed to areas where they can be used. Those solids can be used for other possibilities too, other than being spread or as a fertilizer. They can be recycled as cow bedding. We can use it to be the base of a compost pile. And I've even seen organizations using it to create packaging.
All right. Thank you so much, George, for that call. So, you know, Jessica, how do biodigesters stack up against wind and solar, which seem to be out front with their technology as a cleaner source of energy than farm manure?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're a dairy state. So, you know, that's a $45 billion of our state economy. And, you know, I'll agree with you. Wind and solar definitely, you know, are less expensive, but we've got a challenge, you know, to deal with in the amount of manure that our state creates. So we really see this as digesters being able to support both the dairy industry while creating renewable energy and also being able to help reduce the impact on surface and groundwater.
So, you know, going back to legislation, and you said you have legislative goals tied to biodigestion efforts, what can the state government do to help biogas production efforts? And what is the role of state and federal government here?
Yeah, well, I can tell you specifically about what we're up to. We have an effort that we've been working on for about a year with Representative Gary Tauchin, and it's called the Wisconsin Agriculture, Carbon, Energy, and Water Legislative Effort. And what we're trying to do here is create a voluntary, market-driven opportunity for animal ag farmers where they would be rewarded for well, it rewarded isn't exactly the right. What we would do is carbon credits would be generated for farms who choose to participate for any practices that either sequester carbon in the soil or capture greenhouse gas.
So what is the status of legislation like that, and what are you optimistic that it will get through?
Yeah, we are very excited. So 7 years ago, this never would have been a conversation. And like everything, you know, we start to learn more, you know, we can see the impact of facilities on local waters. You know, Dane County built two community digesters in the hope of, you know, reducing runoff into the chain of lakes, and they've seen a lot of positive impacts. So we're you know, that's the hope on that. And you know, this is what I like to say, our farms have followed their nutrient management plans set forth by the DNR, and we are also facing water quality challenges. So as a collective, as a state, through private-public partnerships, we'll find an answer on how to reduce any further impact.
If you're just joining us, we have Jessica Niekraz, board chair for the Wisconsin Biomass Energy Coalition, promoting renewable natural gas digester facilities. You can join in on biodigesters, what you see going on in your community converting animal and food waste. 800-642-1234. Jessica, who in Wisconsin is regulating these biodigesters? Does it come under the auspices of the DNR? Like, where is the regulation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kate, it is the Department of Natural Resources. And those rules were created, the late 00s, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And as we, you know, we have permits, we are, you know, we are checked. We do a lot of reporting for that. So these are very regulated facilities.
So going back to the economics for a moment, you know, UW Oshkosh Foundation filed for bankruptcy in 2017. And part of that debt they got into was because they had sunk a ton of money into two biodigesters. You know, who at the end of the day should be financing biodigesters? Who should take on the risk and assume the overhead costs?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I'm an expert for that, but I'll give you my two cents. In the case of the university, I would, you know, the reason that these facilities fail is because we don't have people who understand how they work. So more education, you know, that's more education for operators, for, you know, actually it's mostly operators. It's very hard to find people who want to do the job, because it's messy. It's a tough job. They work outside in the winter and they go down into pits to fix pumps. And, you know, it's not for everyone.
What about the smell? That the odor has been also a concern. Also, what do you do with the byproduct, the slurry from these digesters?
Sure. Odor is addressed through the processing, through the digestion process. I was at on a panel yesterday with an engineer, Steve Dvorak, and he was explaining how the bugs actually break down a lot of the things that create the odor in the digestion process. So when it comes out the other side, I wouldn't say you're going to dab it behind your ears and go out on a date, but it is not the same as raw manure at all. To the point that I have stood at some farm pits and taken a big deep breath and been okay. So the digestion process really does help reduce odor. When the farm spread a digested product, it is it's not the same as, you know, when you drive past a farm that just spread.
Sure. we heard from Tim and Madison called, couldn't stay with us. Tim wants to know why Microsoft is building the biodigester in Dubai and not the United States. And this was because, you know, we saw the reports from that Microsoft was, you know, putting this project together on the first solar-powered biodigester. What do you know there?
And not more than what your staff shared with me. I've read the article. So the sun shines a lot more in Dubai. So that would be my two cents. We do have a local project in the state in Middleton that has just moved over to renewable natural gas, and they added solar panels and some battery storage on the facility. So it's an option. It's not, it's part of a solution and not, I don't think, an entire option. The other piece of that I would say is that will, you know, adding those renewable sources to a project will help lower the carbon intensity score and make it a more attractive project.
Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kate. It was my pleasure.
Jessica Niekras, chair of the Wisconsin Biomass Energy Coalition. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You are with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The economic and social heart of Milwaukee's Black community was demolished by freeway construction in the 1960s. But years of redevelopment efforts are making some community members hopeful that Bronzeville could become a hub for Black culture again. Corrine Hess has more.
Located just 2 miles north of downtown Milwaukee, Bronzeville thrived for decades with vibrant small businesses and a nightlife that drew people across racial lines. Freeway construction in the 1960s meant the loss of more than 8,000 homes and churches, and the once tight-knit community scattered across Milwaukee. Artist Matope Johnson lived in Bronzeville until he was about 8 years old. Johnson is now in his late 60s, but he still remembers how vibrant of a community it once was.
So we could go to, you know, the grocery store, or we can go to the doctor. If the doctor didn't come to us because the doctor actually came to visit you at your home.
Last spring, Johnson opened an art exhibit in Milwaukee detailing what old Bronzeville was like. And with new ethnic restaurants in the neighborhood and stores like the Bronzeville Collective, where 25 local vendors have opened shop, Johnson thinks some of the old vibrancy might be coming back.
What I've seen in the most recent years have really begun to pave the way for a huge improvement.
At the heart of the neighborhood is G's Clippers. Owner Gollin Smith was one of the first pioneers of the new Bronzeville when he moved a shop there in 2006. Walking into G's feels like stepping into another time period. Signs on the door caution guests to protect themselves against COVID-19, but inside, maskless people rap songs from another era. James Flippin has been a barber here for 5 years. He calls G's the neighborhood hangout.
This right here gives you a chance to come back into the inner city a little bit more, see a little bit more of what we have to offer.
In addition to the small Black-owned businesses like G's, there are larger projects in the works. The Greater Milwaukee Foundation and the Medical College of Wisconsin are turning a former Gimbel's department store into offices and programming space. This week, America's Black Holocaust Museum will open after being closed for more than a decade. It was one of the only museums dedicated to telling the history of lynching in the United States when it closed in 2008. The museum was founded by lynching survivor James Cameron, who died at age 92 in 2006. One block over, a closed state office building is slated to be the new Bronzeville Center for the Arts, another anchor for the neighborhood. Artist Della Wells serves on the Arts Center board. She lived in Bronzeville as a child. She says over the years, some independent Black artists and writers remained in Bronzeville, but this project will showcase Black culture and give the artistic community another place to gather.
No one in Wisconsin is really, you know, talking about African-American art and art of the Afro diaspora. By that, I mean the history of it. So we're going to take that mission on.
The momentum is drawing national attention to Bronzeville. Last month, the New York Times featured Bronzeville on its list of 52 places for a changed world. One of the people working behind the scenes is Deshea Agee, who recently led the neighborhood's business improvement district. Agee says people's mindset about the neighborhood's place in the city is changing.
It's just a place that has so much meaning, has so much history. It really inspires me to just keep going and know that there's more to do.
There are still empty lots and storefronts in Bronzeville, but people like Agi see it attracting diverse businesses and residents in one of the most segregated cities in the country, and again ready to make history. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now to people with weakened immune systems and what it feels like to be high risk in these times. As COVID enters its third year, transplant recipients, cancer patients, and millions of other Americans with compromised immune systems may feel left behind as governments lift mask mandates and shift back to normal. Are you immunocompromised? How are you doing? Have you received a fourth COVID vaccine booster? Did that make you feel more confident about being in public spaces? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Janina Smith is a faculty member in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She is medical director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Smith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, how concerned are you for your patients at this point in the pandemic?
Unfortunately, I'm very concerned for the risk to my patients. The Omicron wave, though it may have been listed as mild for many people, was not mild for patients with compromised immune systems.
Can you talk about the two main groups of people who are living with compromised immune systems? I mean, some people are born with immune deficiencies. Other people acquire their immunodeficiency, like through, you know, living life, like, you know, cancer, MS, an organ transplant. Connect the dots for us. Explain how these millions of people can still be vulnerable after having extra COVID vaccine doses.
Absolutely. So you pointed out quite correctly that there are patients who are born with immune defects and those who have acquired immune defects, a lot of times through therapies. So what happens is if, for example, I'm going to use organ transplant as an example because it's a large population.
Close to your heart.
Yes, very close to my heart. The medicines that we use to prevent rejection of the new transplanted organ, the purpose of those is not to be able to develop an immune response. So they reduce the ability to make antibodies against the new organ and to make T cells, which are the cells that are kind of educated as part of our cell-mediated immune response. They're specifically made so that those are not as active to not cause rejection. An unfortunate consequence is that they're not specific for the organ, and they make it so that the immune response isn't strong to anything new that's encountered. So the COVID vaccine, the intention of it is to make a good antibody and T cell response. And what we unfortunately worried and has been confirmed, they don't make good antibodies on average. In fact, after a regular vaccine course, less than 50% of transplant recipients made antibodies that were detectable really at all. And so that's why we recommended the third dose, which was very effective at bumping that up above 60%. But unfortunately, with the Omicron wave, just as it affected others who'd been vaccinated or had some natural immunity because of infection, that did not hold true for our immunocompromised patients. The same is true for patients, for example, with rheumatoid arthritis or other autoimmune conditions. The medicines that are used to treat those are intended to blunt the immune response. And unfortunately, that means that patients are not able to develop immunity to COVID, and are when they get exposed, it's as if they've never their immune system's never seen it before.
So just layering on extra doses of the COVID vaccine may not always be very useful or entirely productive in protecting someone with a weakened immune system.
That's exactly right. We certainly recommend it because some immune response is better than no immune response.
Mm-hmm.
And we did see increase in the immune response after each doses in immunocompromised patients. The dose regimen is 4. However, because of this problem, there are other things that we've tried to do. And I think one of the most important is if a patient can't make antibodies themselves, we can actually give them antibodies. that stay in the system and last about 6 months. And there is a drug that was developed to do just that. One of the unfortunate things is with Omicron, just as it's not as susceptible to immunization-based immunity or even actually infection-based immunity, this infusion of antibodies is not quite as effective in Omicron, but it is something that we can do to protect people who can't make antibodies themselves.
If I'm understanding this, is this called passive immunization, giving monoclonal antibodies to at-risk people to protect them before they get the virus?
That is exactly what it's called. So active immunization is when we ask the immune system to make its own antibodies. Passive is when we realize it may not have time or may not be capable, and we infuse antibodies. That's exactly what it's called.
So at this point, what do you tell immunocompromised patients about how they go about living their life, you know, going out in public or just trying to, you know, go to work or go to the grocery store, to their medical appointments?
Yeah, this is a really important question. I get messages from my patients very frequently that the question of removing mask mandates is quite terrifying to them, and I certainly understand that. While the jury's still out, certainly many places there are no mask mandates, my first recommendation or plea to the public would be to consider maintaining mask mandates in what I call safe spaces. So that's the grocery store, the pharmacy, the healthcare clinic, places of worship, places that people really can't avoid, you know, attending, and that it's an important part to just live life. If that doesn't happen for patients individually, I definitely recommend they get all of their vaccine doses. Some percentage of patients will react. And as I say, after the third dose, we saw up to 60% having good antibody levels. I recommend that they place themselves as candidates for antibody infusions with the passive immunity that we've talked about. And then the next really important step. So when I think about immunity, having antibodies really, the intention is to prevent severe illness, not necessarily getting infected at all. But masks, especially good quality masks, are to prevent infection. And that's true for everybody, whether you're immune compromised or not. I have multiple members of my family and certainly have seen patients who are not immune compromised, but who still felt very sick when they got COVID. So masks still protect individuals. So if you're forced to enter a space where there is a lot of unmasked individuals, the quality of mask matters. So when we're talking about good, better, best, any kind of face shield is better than nothing. Surgical masks are better than cloth face shields. But going up, higher quality masks like the medical respirator that I wear is an N95 that's fitted. That's not in reach for most patients, but N95s that are not fitted, including a very comfortable one that was just released by 3M, is a really good option. And then also K95s, which are healthcare quality masks in other countries, are actually extremely comfortable. They're, for me, much more comfortable than wearing a surgical mask because they fit my face much better, and those provide more protection. And so for my transplant recipients, I do recommend they wear a higher level mask in public.
Let's pause there with transplant infectious disease physician Janina Smith explaining what people with weakened immune systems have experienced in COVID. Should cities renew mask mandates, take other measures to protect immunocompromised residents? Have you gotten COVID and received monoclonal antibodies? What should preventative COVID measures do, or when do they get rolled back? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. The head of the CDC suffered backlash last month, seeming to imply that the only people dying of COVID were people with pre-existing medical issues. We're discussing what it's like to navigate the pandemic with a weakened immune system on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Good Morning America interview with CDC Director Rochelle Walensky was edited down, and then later ABC released the full version after people called her out for being callous, and it prompted the hashtag My Disabled Life is Worthy. Here is the 30-second unedited excerpt of what Walensky said.
A study of 1.2 million people who were vaccinated between December and October and demonstrated that severe disease occurred in about 0.015% of the people who were received their primary series and death in 0.003% of those people. The overwhelming number of deaths, over 75%, occurred in people who had at least four comorbidities. So really these are people who were unwell to begin with.
Do public health leaders and lawmakers respect medical risks in COVID? Still time, 800-642-1234. Transplant infectious disease doctor Janina Smith stays with us. Dr. Smith, what were your thoughts when you heard the CDC director talking there about people who have pre-existing conditions?
I'm not going to lie. I found it devastating. Quote further goes on for her to say that she thought that was good news. And these are my patients, and they're very valuable, vital, important members of our society. And so I certainly didn't find their risk, their illness and their deaths to be good news. I think perhaps, you know, her perspective, looking at all of society and seeing that there was still good vaccine efficacy, you know, of course, is encouraging. But I remain steadfast in my advocacy for patients who are immunocompromised. I would also say that as a practicing physician, persons with four comorbidities doesn't necessarily mean that they're very sick. They may be your coworker, your child's friend's parent, your neighbor. And even regardless, every life, you know, matters. There's a very prominent global health advocate who just died this week, and I'd like to use a quote from him that to have global health equity, no life can be worth more than any other life.
Mm. Let's take a call now. Alyssa's in Sparta. Hi, Alyssa's. Are you there?
Good morning, yes.
Good morning. What would you like to say?
Just along the lines of what you're discussing, I have received both of my vaccinations, my booster, and I am pregnant, which makes me immunocompromised. I obtained COVID in November 2020, and I just obtained COVID last month during the Omicron variant. To paint the picture a little bit, my entire household wears masks when we exit our residence, including my three-year-old. We haven't seen some of our best friends in many months. People kind of ask me where they think I got the variant, and then my answer was, you know, at work or at the gas station, because we even do grocery side pickup. And so I just feel, especially when I was sick and having to isolate from my family, a high level of frustration that what I would classify as kind of compassion fatigue from the general population, and just a lack of caring in a lot of cases.
Compassion fatigue, Dr. Smith.
Absolutely. I think that's a big part of the problem. But ultimately, you know, for me, for example, we talk about burnout as kind of a similar condition of compassion fatigue, really allowing yourself to know your patients and feel for their circumstances and their fears and their suffering really can restore compassion. But I do think that that's the problem overall in terms of leaving behind all of the patients that are immunocompromised and remain at risk, or women like you who are pregnant and therefore at much enhanced risk of sickness and, in fact, mortality from COVID.
Alyssa, thank you for the call. Herb now in Madison. Herb, you are a transplant, a liver transplant recipient.
That's correct.
What would you like to say?
Well, I've been very vigilant throughout the pandemic and following the recommendations of my transplant team. I'm totally vaccinated, including my second booster shot now. I've been very astute in wearing masks and now do a KN95 mask. I avoid crowded places of virtually any kind. But despite all that, I think I'm leading a fairly good life.
Hmm.
I've had to sacrifice doing certain kinds of things, but I replace that with a sense of gratitude, a continual gratitude for being alive today, even all these many years after my transplant. It's been a wonderful life for me.
30 years and counting.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, Dr. Smith, what about this mindset of gratitude?
Oh, it makes me so happy to hear. It is the most rewarding and amazing thing in my entire medical practice to see individuals who are given this new chance at life. And I don't think Herb's attitude is unique amongst transplant recipients. They are resilient and grateful and just such a rewarding population to work with. And I think that's when we're talking about compassion fatigue, that's the part to focus on. These are our amazing fellow Americans, and their lives are worth protecting.
Herb, thank you for joining in as we talk with Dr. Janina Smith, Medical Director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Kevin in Janesville has something to add. Kevin, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I think we're just lifting these mask mandates and recommendations far too early. Doctor, would it be a reasonable analogy to say, hey, cancer patient, your tumor has been shrunk by 50 or 60%, so we're going to stop all chemo and radiation, and we'll just see how it goes, and if things get bad, maybe we can start back up again. How many of us would be okay with that kind of medical advice?
Right. I mean, I agree with you, in particular in regards to safe spaces. I do understand that there are some people who feel that they are themselves at lower risk and want to do something more what I would view as, risky, more likely to lead to exposure, like, you know, eating out in restaurants or going to bars. But when, like our first caller today, who was saying that she severely limited her activities, it's not really fair that she can't go to the gas station or the pharmacy without being put at higher risk. So I entirely do agree with you. The last piece of that is I think people have the attitude now, well, we can't keep doing this forever. Mm-hmm. But the reality is there's been amazing scientific advances, absolutely amazing during the pandemic, including the development of the monoclonal antibodies that are long acting and protective, as we talked about, but also therapeutics mm-hmm. that have been developed are really quite effective, but not available. There's just not enough of them. And so I don't think it's a matter of holding out forever. I think it's a matter of holding out until some of these other agents that we know work until that they are accessible to everyone.
Dr. Smith, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's such an important topic.
Dr. Janina Smith, faculty member in the Division of Infectious Disease at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, medical director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Just ahead, we start a series of conversations about the Great Lakes with the executive director of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and a research ecologist with NOAA. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.